What is up, everybody? Adrian M. Gibson here. What you're about to hear is the audio version of a live author panel recorded during TBRCon 2024, the latest edition of FanFiatic's all-virtual annual science fiction, fantasy, and horror convention, which streamed live between January 21st and January 28th, 2024. FanFiatic and TBRCon had the pleasure of hosting 25 amazing author panels, and we're so happy to be able to provide the audio for you for free here on the podcast feed. So, sit back, relax, and enjoy this fantastic TBRCon 2024 author panel.
Greetings, everyone, and welcome. My name is Jonathan Nevers. I'm the author of the space opera series Windtide and the Agent Renault Spy-Fi Adventures, and I'm delighted to be here to moderate a panel with these really, truly stellar authors on building believable science fiction worlds. We're going to have a really nice discussion today, hopefully cover some aspects where these authors share insights, wisdom, and maybe even some trade secrets on how to craft believable worlds in science fiction. So we're going to jump right in. I'm going to go around and ask each author if they would please introduce themselves and just give us a brief little introduction to the type of work that they've done in science fiction. So I'm going to go ahead and ask Marina to start.
All right. I'm Marina Lofstetter. I've written things like the Numenon series and Activation Degradation. One spans several millennia. One takes place in a week. That's me. I'm here.
All right. Welcome. Christopher?
I'm Christopher Rocchio. I write the Sun Eater science fantasy series, the first book's Empire of Silence. I was also, for 7 years, junior editor at Bain Books.
Great. Thanks. And Taryn?
I'm Taryn Hunt. I'm author of The Immortality Thief, which is about a linguist who gets blackmailed into stealing things.
Excellent. Aliette?
Hi, I'm Aliette, and I made the terrible mistake of doing this with two young children at home, as you have probably seen. My name is Aliette de Baudard. I write fantasy and science fiction. In particular, I'm the author of The Universe of Suya, which is a Vietnamese space opera. And the latest book in the series just came out. Will you choose a number? And my assistant here will show you the book. It's called The Fireborn of Exile.
Excellent. Woohoo. Yay for assistance, too. Okay, Hugh.
Hi, I'm Hugh. I've written mostly fantasy stuff, but I have done a bit of sci-fi. There's that one. That's an actual novel. That's mostly about Romans. It's very confusing. There's some short stuff as well. But yeah, happy to be here.
Great. Thank you all. All right. So I'm hoping we can cover a lot of ground today. Obviously, this is a massive topic. It's as big as a galactic empire unto itself. So, you know, we're going to try to focus in on some specific things that relate to science fiction and believability as much as possible. But I wanted to start with a broad stroke and ask each of you, you know, what is important to you when you're crafting a believable world in science fiction? So, you know, what do you expect to be working? What's something that you hope to see in a world building practice to make something believable? And I'm going to start with Taryn.
For me, it's most important that the characters themselves really believe in it, that they have the sort of assumptions and biases that would come from living in that kind of world. I think that makes it feel more grounded and more real to the reader. And to me, the writer.
Yeah, and I think we'll try a little later to talk about that kind of relativity of experience, depending on who you are and where you are in a world, which will be great. How about you, Marina?
I usually try to start with some good factual touchstones when it comes to sci-fi, especially, to make sure that you're kind of like working in a believable baseline for the reader that's based in, you know, things that they would know, and then you extrapolate from that. So really being able to ground something hard and then go crazy with it is kind of how I try to put in some vermiculitude there.
Interesting. Yeah, and we're going to talk about openings too, I think, in a little bit as well. Christopher, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, it's hard for me to pin down any one thing that I look for specifically, but you want some sort of internal self-consistency, right? Whether that's a deeply outlandish sort of world or one very close to reality. Obviously, you're closer to reality, like she's saying. You want stuff to be sort of more grounded, but if you can go as out there as you want, as long as it all holds together in some way, you just need to keep a delicate enough touch that you don't lose your readers, and I think you can get away with a lot of stuff as far as world building is concerned. So.
Elliot?
Yeah, I think I'm with Chris here, which is that there's a number of things that you can get away with as long as the reader lets you get away with it, and to me, a lot of this is establishing trust, which is a sort of continuous hand-waving of, trust me, I know what I'm doing, on thin, sliding, cracking ice, especially in the of this delicate juggling exercise where you're trying to convey as much as you can about the world building without breaking too much the reader's mind. And I'm also not helped by I use a lot of Vietnamese cultural things, which require extra exposition because they don't feel as natural, quote unquote, to a Western audience. So to me, a lot of this is kind of sleight of hand, I think is what I would call it. You are kind of giving an illusion that it's here and kind of using the reader's own structures in the brain to carry off a lot of things.
Interesting. Yeah, I hope we can talk more about that a little later too, that kind of balancing act, and depending on who the reader is. I think that's really interesting. Hugh, did you want to add anything?
Yeah, I guess it's to get that kind of, when you have a big world, something really big and strange you're trying to construct, the small things are often the things that I find ground it really nicely. Like the little details that you don't necessarily think of, but actually when you take your whatever you've changed and you spiral it all out, like, oh no, you wouldn't have a word for that. I think yesterday I was writing something, I described something as sounding like bees, and then I realized that nobody in this world would ever have seen a bee. And I was like, okay, I need a new noise that makes this make sense. And if you get the little things like that, then it kind of makes everything click together a little more, I think.
Yeah. So we might as well get this question out of the way now so we can move on to other things. And that is, so what's your method? How do you world build? Is it consistent across your writing process? Are you an early builder, a pre-builder? Are you a build as you go? Are you get a plot and character out and go back and fill in afterwards? If you build early, how do you keep track of your worlds? So I'm going to throw this one out to start. I'll just go right back to you, Hugh.
I very much make stuff up as I go along. I start, I think, oh, that's a cool idea. And I sort of start writing and then realize as I go, like, oh, no, this isn't going to make sense. I need to do this. And I construct, yeah. It's that, what is it, Plotter versus Pantser. I just sort of hack my way through a jungle until I find something that's useful and hope that it's going to come along the way. And it all kind of falls into place as I go, really. I definitely don't, but I should.
Do you find that you have to go back and do a lot of work post-draft to the world building to get that consistency, or is it just something that you're so good that you just do it?
Often I do, yeah. I think of something cool about two-thirds of the way through, and then I'm like, right, okay, that needs to be there at the start. I need to go back and slot that in. That happens quite a lot. Yeah, I've tried to plan more these days. It doesn't work. It still happens.
How about you, Marina?
I also world build as I go because, yeah, that's part of the fun of the writing for me is the discovering all the little bits and pieces of how it's coming together. I often start in a place of like, what if this world was X or had Y, and then build from there as I'm writing. So some sort of world thing often is an initial spark of the idea. But then as I'm going, I'm riffing off of different ideas and thinking up new things because, yeah, that's the cool, fun part. And if I try to build it ahead of time, I feel like I'm restricting myself. But that's me personally. I know other people have to work completely opposite of that.
Okay, Christopher, so what about you?
Yeah, so for me, it sort of depends on the detail in question, right? Because sometimes it's a world-building idea that's the germ of the story, right? And in those cases, you know, you start with that. I have sort of a weird, I guess, advantage in that most everything I've written has been in the same universe at this point. So a lot of the big stuff is kind of baked into the pie at this point. And so with that stuff, I figured out a lot in advance. I as a kid, I wanted to be like Tolkien, right? So world building was for him sort of the point. And so I did a lot of stuff up front. Now as the series goes on, I sort of figure out most of the big stuff in the outlining phase. I'm a big outliner, but I leave room, especially for sort of smaller things. I might mention like a throwaway detail about a planet and make up the planet in that moment or things like that. I remember I talked to Lois Bujold once when I was working for Bain, and she told me she mostly world builds as she goes. And that was a deeply liberating thing to hear from Lois Bujold. I chilled out after that. So I've been a little bit more flexible, but it's still, sometimes you start with something, need to start with something. So,
and so do you have a kind of a database or something like that you work with to keep track?
A little bit. I have some invented languages that I've got very messy grammar notes on, for example. I've got a catalog of planets that I've made up just to remember in case I don't have to necessarily duplicate a planet, a lot of it's just in the outline and it's sort of stored in active memories. I've been working on this one project for so long. It's been easier to keep a lot of that stuff sort of in play. I do keep some notes, but most of it's sort of confined to the book outlines themselves.
I definitely want to come back a little later. I have a question about writing a series and subsequent books in the same world for all of you to address as well. Taryn, did you want to give us a sense of what your process is?
I'm sort of like everyone else. I world build as I go. I like to start with a character. And so then I want to see where the character goes. And then the world building for me is more about what would be interesting in this moment, and also what context would make this character be or become the person that I want them to be.
Aliette?
I am a total architect. My day job is engineering, where I build things that will hit the pipeline and production pipeline in like 6 or 7 months time. And by that time, they kind of, the lower you go on the implementation cycle, the higher the cost of mistakes. And I sort of very much apply that approach to my writing. So I have been known to design an entire set of space traveling methods because I was writing a story about space pirates, and about, I don't know, halfway into the planning, I just got, I have no idea how space piracy actually works. How do you board a vessel? That does not make sense. So I took a friend on Skype and I said, look, I need some help. And we spent about an hour and 30 minutes brainstorming space travel and what would space pirates do and practically how you would fit the vessels and so on and so forth. You are allowed to guess how much of that made it into the actual novel. Not much. Maybe like 2 lines.
That's pretty typical, right?
Yeah.
Let's just talk about that. I was going to go there later. Let's talk about research since you bring it up. I mean, because, you know, we end up doing these things, right, where we end up down rabbit holes and we go into these really unusual places to get just a small little nugget of information that's so vital to us, right, in the building of a world. So, how much research do you all do? And in particular, I have a kind of a fun question attached to this. What's the most oddball or strange thing you've researched in the process of putting together one of your books, if you have one? And I'm going to open this up. Does anyone want to jump in?
Oh, I can talk about
it. Go for it.
So I do a lot of research. And the book I was thinking of talking about is The Red Scholar's Wake, which was it's basically a queer space pirates with arranged marriage. Lesbian arranged marriage. I based it on the 19th century relationships between Vietnam, China, and a bunch of pirates that were operating in the South China Sea at that point. So that is not the oddball thing. The oddball thing is that I ended up researching the political relationships between Vietnam and China. And what I found out was that Vietnam sent an imposter emperor to the 80th birthday of the Chinese emperor because they didn't want their emperor to be taken hostage. Meanwhile, the Chinese did not want to admit that there was an imposter because they would have lost face. So everybody sort of pretended that everything was fine for the entire duration of the thing. And you have the Vietnamese going like, ha, 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 we got them. And the Chinese going like, it was so great. The Vietnamese emperor came and so on and so forth. And I was like, oh, my God, I have never managed to put this in the story, but I kind of want to. I mean.
Yeah, that is great. Anyone else have anything they've researched which has made its way in or maybe will make its way in someday? Has anyone done any experiential, anything experiential in the process of research for a book you've written or a story you've written? Have you actually ever taken classes or done anything as an experience to better? Christopher, have you done anything in your or in your past that's made it in? I think you're muted. Christopher, I think you're muted.
He's in full flow.
I forgot I had it muted. Great.
That's okay. It was great. We had great fun.
Amazing. Awesome. Right. I was saying, yes, I did Olympic fencing, Olympic style fencing. I wasn't obviously at the Olympics. And I did a little bit of HEMA and I did a couple years of boxing, not because I was doing that expressly for research because I wanted to, but you know, one writes action scenes. And so this isn't like a oddball thing that I was researching, but what is oddball about it is that if one were to walk into my office while I'm writing, one will frequently find me with my eyes closed, pantomiming, as if I had a sword, often holding a cane or something, trying to figure out, okay, then I would go here, right? So I write those scenes pretty kinetically. There used to be scuff marks on my ceiling in my old office from the cane. So I had to stop doing that. But my wife's always like, hey, can I come sit with you while you write? I'm like, no, it's a little bit too weird.
You accidentally smack her with
that. Yeah, that's really.
Problem.
So, one of the things that came to mind when I was thinking about the fact that we're talking specifically about science fiction, and most of us are writing in secondary worlds or in future worlds that are either closely linked to Earth history or far beyond current time, is just the general concept of space, right? And physical space and vastness, but also time. And perhaps most important is history. That, you know, how do we get to the point in our stories where we're telling a narrative that is taking place in the now? And one of the questions that I wanted to ask you all is related to the idea of why is it the way it is now in a world, right? That when we're telling the story, we're situating ourselves in a certain point in this imaginative history, right? And the question is, well, why is it this way now? And we often have to go about a process of referring to history, whether it's a faucet drip method or by some other means. So my question for all of you is specific to each of your work around this, that Taryn, I'm going to start with you. I really liked the way that you incorporated backstory early on in The Immortality Thief. And I was wondering, could you just talk a little bit about the kind of strategy and approach you used to kind of start a story, but then build out the backstory that was necessary?
Well, I tried to tie it very closely to the main character because then it made it more natural for things to come up. Like Sean is preoccupied with the specific political situation, which is that two solar systems are about to be at war. So that's really on his mind. So, of course, he's going to think about it. And because we're in his perspective, we hear about it from him and we immediately gain a sort of sense of caring because it's in his mind. And then I just tried to tether history and backstory and world building to different characters so that I wasn't giving a lecture on, oh, back in, 50 years ago, there was this battle and that sort of thing, but more like someone comes up and she's like, oh, I'm here because of this thing, or, I care about what's going on with this part of the world because of this past history. And then it's sort of looped in, and especially the history of the spaceship that they're robbing is closely tied to the characters who are there in a very intimate way, as you realize as you go through. So for me, tying it to the characters helps it flow and helps me not get stopped up and helps me introduce things as the reader needs to know them.
Interesting. And Marina, you used vignettes in Noumenon, right? I mean, could you talk a little bit about how that worked with world building, choosing that format and how it worked?
That was fun because it was like cheating. So I'd mostly just written short stories prior to that. So really, I was just writing a bunch of little short stories in the same world to make a big overarching plot line. But a lot of my work, my background's in history, and a lot of it is related to how people repeat history and how we also forget our history or purposely skew our history to try to create new realities, and how non-specific and non, there's a lot of science that is hard X, Y, and Z. And then there's a lot of history that is really interpretation. There's factual events, but then you're seeing it through the eyes of the people who recorded it, who also have biases. So I do a lot of like, our history matters, but it gets misconstrued and warped as you go. And it was fun to be able to do that in Noumenon specifically, start out with a very near future situation and get to an extreme thousands of years in the future, looking back at how have the characters themselves created a mythology around what happened. And a lot of my work is about looking at hidden history or skewed history. So I love doing that. It's a very important part of my world building.
And Hugh, excuse me, you chose to link your story with a tangible historical precedent, right? One that I think qualifies as early science fiction. Could you talk a little bit about what that offered you and how you expanded from there?
Yeah, so you were saying that, it's the world the way it is now. I was kind of cheating because the world the way it is now is based on the world the way it was then, in that it's based on something from about 100 AD-ish, old Greco-Roman satirical piece called The True History, which is sort of, all these travel writers are saying, I've been to Egypt, it's like this, there are people with three heads. No, there aren't. You've never been there. Shut up. I'm going to show you how, if you're going to make stuff up, do it properly. I've been to the moon. And they go to the moon. Giant island made of cheese. There's an island with a whale with a continent in its belly. Everyone on the moon flies around a three-headed vulture, etc. So I had all this mad stuff, which is presented in that very matter-of-fact classic where I was like, oh yeah, it was like this. Moving on. The moon and the sun are at war. Why? I don't know. They just were. We got involved. Why not? And that was sort of, I have these events, I have all these concepts, and I needed to get reasons why this was happening. So you have the moon versus the sun. They need to actually be fighting over something, and sort of teasing out the little strands of stuff I could work on from there was the most entertaining thing. And then like sensibilities of characters wasn't totally classical because that's very hard to do, and it had to be relatable to the modern reader a bit more. But delving into the concept, like what if you are the theoretical character of a Greek who's just nipped off to the moon from 100 AD, what are you going to think when you see this stuff other than, oh God, I'm on the moon? How? Why? It was little things, just small things like, okay, they need to be fighting over something. Here is a colony planet. Why would giant fire monsters from the sun want to settle on this world? And I had to come up with, they needed resources, the other planet needed space for citizens. It all kind of tied itself together quite nicely as it went along. I did have the benefit of that vague story structure to work with to start with, but it ended up being a lot more expansive. Like when the writer's character said, oh yes, and then we went to the sun, you go, hang on, you can't do that. It's the sun. I need to figure out how they can survive in the sun. And that was then another bit of well-being from there. Yeah. That was essentially, it was explaining mad things and making them still seem very mad, but also work in a very, very loose, not hard at all sci-fi context.
That's fascinating. Excuse me. That's fascinating. Elliot, the Suya universe is vast as a galactic empire. And I have to say, your historical chronology is breathtaking. I highly recommend, by the way, anyone who hasn't been to your website, they should go to your website if they're interested in the Suya universe and look. I was fascinated by the historical timeline that you constructed. Could you talk a little bit about why you did that and how it serves served you and the overall, and how it serves the overall world that you've created. Because you, if I'm correct, you not only built a futuristic projected chronology, right? But you went back a little bit as well from the present. Could you talk about that?
Yeah. There originally was, so originally the Suya universe was a series of like pseudo noir short stories and an alternate sort of end of 20th century, beginning of 21st century, where the North American continent was split between the Mexicas, so the Aztecs, a Chinese colony, and a sort of very diminished United States that only occupied like the 13 or so first states on the eastern seaboard. And I kind of also wanted to do space opera, and I'm lazy. So I'm like, you know what? I could take the entire thing and like put it in space, right? And then along the way, I added like, I sort of projected it a long time into the future. And that when I write something like that, what I usually do is I keep in mind that, you know, living memories around two generations, give or take. I mean, obviously, it depends on like lifespan and so on and so forth. So obviously, you have to adjust for that. But you basically, you know, the oldest person who's able to tell you things is the last thing that you're going to experience as secondhand. And then the sort of I guess cultural memory is like not that long either, right? A lot of the things that we take for granted are actually, you can trace them to 19th century structures. I'm fascinated by the 19th century, so I admit to a little bit of bias there, but you can trace, for instance, a lot of French customs back to the 19th century, including wedding customs and a bunch of other things, right? And everything is always in the state of flux, but it's interesting to realize that a lot of it is fairly recent. So usually when I put a point in the future, I'm like, okay, what happened in the last 15 years or so that's going to be very vivid? In the last 50 years or so, that's going to be your grandfather's time. And in the last 100 to 200 years, before that, and that's going to be kind of the kind of bones of the society and the kind of assumptions that they're working with. And I think I'm going to need to take this elsewhere, otherwise it's very noisy. And then sometimes I just, I mean, basically it was a sandbox for me to play in, right? So sometimes I just added data points. I have ship mines, which are artificial intelligences that are implanted in the body of the ship. And part of one thing I got fascinated by was like, okay, but like, how did that happen? And so one of the stories I wrote is about the accidental discovery that one could merge with a spaceship, and that sort of unrolls the entire timeline of, okay, we're going to do things differently science-wise. So... I mean, yeah, it's. I think it's always a compromise for me between, I would like to write about everything that's happened in the last 2,000 years. I'm very lazy and I don't have time for this. And also the reader probably doesn't want to know, at least in text, what happened during the last 2,000 years. They might want to know in, you know, supplements and annexes and stuff, but like nobody, I mean, very few people actually read science fiction to get potted history.
That's, I don't know about you being lazy, but considering how prolific you are, but that's fascinating. The idea of memory and this kind of pale of memory as you go back and thinking about how clear and then how much becomes indistinct, and crafting that into world building is such a fascinating concept. That's something I'm going to take away from this for sure. So speaking of thousands of years, let's move to Christopher. So Christopher, 16,000, am I correct? 16,000 years or so?
Since the founding of the empire in question, about 20 from now.
From now. So, I have a question for you, which is how, seriously. So I wanted to ask you about your opening actually in Empire of Silence, because, can you talk a little bit about that opening literary move you make in the first scene of light where you introduce us to your main character, because you seem to be able to incorporate an immense history and kind of set us in this world really quickly and successfully. And I just wondered if you had any thoughts on why you did that, or how you navigated an approach trying to set us into your world.
What's that?
It's a long question. I'm sorry, but
no, that's okay. At least my mic is on this time. My initial instinct had been to sort of ape Homer with the one word opening, seemed like the thing to do. And to sort of ape that style of giving sort of broad strokes, introductions to the universe, the characters, the conflict, right? Sing O'Muse of the Rage of Achilles, Peleus' son, blah, blah, blah. It worked for the Greeks, you know, why not? The thing to keep in mind, if there are any new writers who are listening, is that you should trust your readers, actually. And you can provide them with like the tip of an iceberg. And you might not actually, as the writer, know what the shape of that full iceberg is every time, right? And the reader will generate in their own heads answers to questions that you aren't even posing as the writer, right? And so you can give people the names of characters, of places, of events, and very brief descriptions. And they'll see a lot more than you put on the page, right? Now, my books are each like 250,000 words long, but books used to be a lot shorter and used to still quite effectively communicate these points, because readers are filling in a lot of the blanks in their own heads. And so if you give people these sort of little vignettes or these little flashes, or even like an epithet, if you give them like one sentence, they will grow a lot of that history in their own brains. Now, they might not have exactly the same vision you as the writer have, but you can clarify these things later. And so you don't often need to give, your readers a complete picture or like a multi-page backstory or info dump at every given point, right? Or even at any given point, you can give them little pieces and they can kind of forensically reconstruct what you're talking about over the course of the story. And so if you give them enough of the right pieces early on, then you can get going really quickly with just a couple paragraphs. I'm deeply sort of influenced by Gene Wolfe, right? Who's sort of the king of trusting his readers, right? And some might say trust them too far, since there are so many people like, I don't know what I just read, Gene. And like, don't worry, read it four more times and you'll get it, right? But I think that was sort of my guiding light, as it were, was to sort of give these little pieces to people that they go back and to fill later as it became relevant to whatever the scene was. And I've done that kind of with each book. Each book takes place usually several centuries after the previous one. The same characters are still around. They live a lot longer, or they've been frozen, but the events and actions have been removed from the end of the last book by so much that usually the beginning is disorienting in the same way. And I use the same technique with this series, to sort of get things going again. And wait, what happened? What did I miss? I think often sometimes that the questions that readers ask are more nutritious for them than the answers we give them. And so when they're like, wait, what happened? Or what is that? Or what was that about? And they go off imagining, then the book lives with them a lot longer than if they just have an answer. They know 2 and 2 is 4. But if they are just introduced to the concepts of 2, they might have to go figure out what 4 is on their own, so to speak. I, as a kid, was always really taken with the edges of Tolkien's maps. Rune and Harad don't appear in the story at all, right? But I wanted to know. And since they weren't there, I would think about them because of their absence as much or more than I thought about Gondor or Arnor. So that was sort of an early start for me thinking about things this way.
Putting together some kind of a catalyst for the reader to then, right, sort of self-visualize or further, right, develop what you've given them from that's on the page.
Yeah. And again, it's okay if they come away with the wrong impression, right? People do that with real historical events all the time, right? Like Marina was saying, you can look at one, like only one thing happens, right? That event looks different depending on where you're standing, or can be made to look different. And so if the reader comes away you know, confused about the events of at least Hadrian's story, I find that that's sometimes a bonus because, like Marina was saying, I'm also very interested in sort of the subjective histories and people's competing perceptions. And I've written short stories from other characters' points of view that clash with the main novels on purpose, and that's sort of fun. So. You know, if the readers have their own perspective separate to the two characters in question, all the better. That I do most of the time know what the truth is. I'm not saying it's completely chaotic by any means, but you don't have to put it all on the page either.
Maybe just to pick up on something you're saying, we'll go with this now too, and that is short form fiction. So I know most of you have written short form fiction, and maybe I'll just throw this out there. So what changes with regard to world building when you're working in a short form, like a short story, or even something shorter, whether it's flash? What are some of your thoughts on that? Does anyone want to jump in? How do you adjust your world building approach from a novel length project?
I tend to keep it a lot tighter to whatever like the exciting thing is, if that makes sense. Like, because there's always the core thing of like, what if the world but this? I tend to keep it a lot tighter to that because you don't need to go into so much of the, I don't know, tax laws and galactic politics necessarily. If you're doing a shorter one, you're trying to keep it tight, building what you need to into the story rather than everything you want to, which I'm really bad at planning that and keeping myself restrained, but I do try.
Anyone else? Marina, do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, you got to be really choosy. And also one thing I've learned is, so I've taken short stories before and expanded them into things that become novels. And you learn a lot about how things that you can make sense in short form don't make sense when you try to extrapolate out. And you're like, oh, wait, I have to create new rules for that to make any sort of sense at all. So it's kind of freeing in that you can just be like, hey, this star is alive. And you don't have to be like, hey, now I'm going to explain why the star is alive, right? Like, you just be like, okay, it's just short fiction. You're going to run with it. So I feel like in short form, you get a small amount of time to earn the reader's trust. And you just kind of have to barrel through with a lot of things that you would maybe give more details and expect them to want to ask more questions about in a longer form.
Taryn, do you have any thoughts to add to that?
I don't write a lot of short fiction. I really prefer long novels. But when I have written short stories, it's been very like single concept based because you don't have the space to elaborate. And if you elaborate, then that's the whole story. So.
Okay. And Aliette, you've written quite a few short stories. Do you have any thoughts on that?
I tend to limit the cast more. Like I tend to just have fewer characters. And I have a world-building approach where I will throw things at the wall and sort of not fully explain them, but let the reader build an image in their mind, which works so long as I don't overwhelm the reader with it. So I think it's also a matter of like being, as Marina was saying, fairly choosy with what you take, what I put in the short story. And a lot of it, I think, to me, flows organically because a lot of the world building comes across through little details, right? For instance, at one point in a book that I was writing, so I actually think it's a novel, but I would have done the same thing in the short story, where one of the character suits up to go into space. And as she's doing that, she is running through the automated checklist of, she lives in a space habitat, and she is running through the automated checklist of like all the drills of what to do if your bit of the habitat loses power and then loses oxygen. And so you kind of, in a few sentences, you get, not only is she preparing to go onto this, this spacewalk, but also you get an impression of how she's grown up and how her world is set up because it's been filled with those, okay, always have to be ready that something could actually go wrong here. And it was just three sentences and I never come back to it, but I think it adds a lot of bulk to the, okay, this is the character that we're dealing with and the way she's inextricably tied to how she grew up.
That's a great transition. Let's talk about little things. Let's go from that macrocosmic sort of historical breadth to the really, really small minutiae, excuse me, and how much that serves world building and believability. And Taryn, maybe I'll start with you on this one. The small details, how do you use them to affect in world building? And, you know, can you share an example?
So Immortality Thief is from the perspective of its first person. So it's very deeply in the main character's head. And I, like, for small details, I wanted to have him refer to things that he doesn't explain. Like, nothing big, but just, like, he's talking about an animal and he uses a word that is not a word that is English or any other language that exists currently. But you know from context what it is. Like, he has this little memory of finding what is basically a rabbit that got attacked by an owl. But he calls it a Kona, and it's just little details like switches in language that don't need to be translated or explained in the text to give a sense of like a different world, a different context, and thoughts in his head that do not directly align with what we know as people who do not live in his world.
How about you, Christopher? I don't use details.
Yeah, well, little details are really a quick way to get people to understand that they're not in Kansas anymore, right? I was thinking about examples, I think maybe one of the more famous ones is Heinlein talking about the doors dilating, right? Just the doors open in a strange way, and this causes you to rethink where and when you are, right? And that's just one word choice, right? And so a lot of little things can be handled in little ways like that, right? By sort of word choice to, by doing weird things like Gene Wolfe's horses have talons, right? It's not quite a horse, right? And so if, you know, the careful reader is wondering, wait, hang on, what's going on? But they're reminded that this isn't home, right? This isn't looking outside. But when you're, by contrast, if you're doing something that's sort of historical or more grounded, this is where the research can really come in. I had to edit a Tim Power story, and he was talking about bakelite, which I did not realize was an older word for a certain kind of plastic, right? And so I needed to go figure out what he was talking about. And Tim Powers is a writer who really, really, really does his research. So you can communicate a lot by these little things. And this is a place too where we're sort of figuring out your names for everything and fitting those names together, because names in real life broadly are related, right? Linguistically, etymologically, and putting your work in there can make things a lot more believable. You know, just making sure that if you're writing about an insular, you know, island kingdom, right? Like, you maybe shouldn't pull that has had no contact with the world outside. Maybe you shouldn't pull inspirational language from, say, England, but also Spain, right? Like, maybe that wouldn't make sense in context, right? Place names are a great way to sort of build a sense of place, right? And, you know, whether you're pulling from real world stuff or building your own language, you know, you need to think about how the names for places and people and items relate to one another. So those are a nice little sort of little thing you can do.
And Hugh, how about you? The buzzing of bees. So what are some yeah. small tidbits and details, and how do you exploit that to effect?
Yeah, I mean, I guess thinking of Ad Luna, particularly, like, that's such a strange world that giving the touchstones there is, it's like the inverse, because it was humans coming into an alien society, but the POV was the alien society, so it kind of was backwards a bit. But I think there's the bit when you slowly realize as you go along that all of these moon people, they're all men. Weird. Okay. And then the humans bring some women along and you realize, oh no, they literally have one gender, their species has one gender, they're all men. When he talked about having two dads, his dads aren't gay. Everyone is gay. They're all gay space elves. Hooray. But having them sort of be slightly freaked out, like, what do you mean you've got two genders? What? This is confusing. It just, like, throws them off for a minute. And then they take it in their stride and move on. They don't have cloth, because it's, again, like Lucian giving you random bits of world building. Like, yeah, they all wear metal and glass clothes. Like, okay, cool. So I can't have cloth ripping that's not going to work. I need to have something else. They're all going to be wearing kind of chainmail around the place. Small things just sort of tip it, make it just that little bit weirder, which is nice when you're already writing weird.
Yeah, that's really interesting, the idea of rather than, I think I default to additive, right? Like to enhancing and adding to the present conditions, but the idea of being subtractive as a way to kind of destabilize us, right, from what we're used to being in the ordinary world is really interesting. Marina, did you want to add anything to that?
Sure. I was still thinking too about the short story aspect, yeah, about how you have to be choosy. And my general writing philosophy in any system is that anything you put in should be doing at least double, if not triple duty. So it's showing you character, it's showing you world, it might be showing you plot, it's definitely giving you tone. So details are really a good way. Whatever little detail you pick can be doing a lot of things at the same time. So I really like to not just like, I'm going to describe one thing and give this one detail about it, but here's that detail again from another character's point of view, so you can see how it feels different or how it shifts the tone when it's being looked at from a different perspective. And on the short story scale, I try to do it like in every sentence is trying to pull this triple double duty thing. But in longer form, you kind of like pull it back to like, all right, this paragraph can be doing two things now, but the details always help you show different sides of things, not just an individual point in something.
And Aliette, if I could ask, since you started us off by mentioning the little things, could you talk for a moment about food and the way food works in your universe?
I mean, more than a moment, but I suppose ideally nobody would like me to take over the panel.
So no, yeah. But in brief, if you could just tell us maybe, you know, or use an example of...
Sure. I mean, food is something that I'm very preoccupied with because I grew up in two food-obsessed cultures, so Vietnam and France, which are two different kinds of obsession, and I like cooking myself. And to me, I mean, food socially has several functions. You know, there's a lot of rituals around the preparation of food, right? I remember... every Christmas, you have everybody gathering together in the kitchen or every New Year's to just like make the dishes that everybody's going to consume. But it's a very, you know, in my family, it used to be all the women, right? Because it was a fairly patriarchal thing. And they would all talk about fairly specific thing. And then the conversation would shift when one of the husbands entered the kitchen. So you get this socialization. Then you get the big dinner, which is a different kind of socialization. And then you get, obviously, you know, those moments that you share with people in on a less formal plane, right? Coffees with friends, restaurants, that sort of thing. And to me, food is also inextricably tied with memory. To this day, whenever I smell cut garlic, I remember this is how my maternal grandmother's hands used to smell when I came home. To her place, and she served me food and she just cut up the garlic, right? And it brings up a very strong memory of me being small and her standing in the kitchen. And I want some of that memory tying, some of that affection for food to make its way into the writing. So it happens to my characters. Obviously, they have those things happening to them. And I have, I also have the aforementioned sentient spaceships. And one of the questions I had to ask myself was, okay, fine, but what are they eating? They don't actually need to eat. And then I thought, no, they don't. But considering how socially important food is, I need to come up with something that they would be doing while everybody is off having drinks. And so what I came up with was like, okay, so they're actually consuming virtual drinks, which are sort of layered memories. And the more skilled your virtual cook is, the better quality of memories you're going to evoke. And obviously then the question, you know, becomes, okay, but humans could do that too, right? And what would be the effect of humans and so on? So it opened up a lot of really interesting questions and really interesting things about, you know, the different spaces being occupied by those. They're not different species, but they're two different sets of people with very different lifespans, very different preoccupations, very different ideas of embodiment, et cetera, et cetera. So it was really interesting to see the world building through the lens of that. I would say not much of it made it into the writing, but actually I do love my food, so a lot of it made it into the writing. And lots of dumplings, because I like dumplings.
We have a question actually from the chat, and I'm going to just throw it up here, and I will also read it. And I'm going to open it up if anyone would like to take this. But how do you respond to critics who treat fun tidbits context as open loops you failed to close? How do you satisfy them and leave some things open to the imagination? Anyone want to take a stab at that?
I mean, do you need to satisfy them?
Yeah, that's what I was going to say, too, is you just ignore them. You know, yeah. Sometimes I will leave details like that and then not explain them on purpose, just because it does bother people. The more my readers communicate that they want to know about something, the less inclined I am to tell them about it. Because it's like I said, those questions are very nutritious for them. And so not giving them answers keeps the mystery alive, and that keeps the book alive in their head after the book is closed, right? And so if something really bothers them, maybe not answering it is the best thing you can do. Although sometimes, you know, they're like, oh, I forgot about that detail. Yeah, I could do something with that. And then thinking about the short story question, it's often from little details like that or something that someone had a question about that I get the idea for a short story. Sometimes I'll reward my readers for hectoring me, but most often I will ignore them.
Sci-fi is meant to be thought-provoking. If you're not gonna, like, you gotta have some, be thinking about it afterwards. The thoughts have been provoked.
Yeah. Carry on, reader. I'm actually reminded of I was watching a lot of UK TV series versus a lot of really US police procedurals, and after a while they all look the same, and I was like, actually it's because it's mostly being done to keep everyone happy. And I had this, you know, this sort of self-reflection of like, actually you can choose to make everyone happy, but the risk is that it can be very bland, and I'd rather be distinctive. Obviously there's, you know, such a thing as breaking too many things at the same time. But I think on balance, sometimes people are not in your target audience, or sometimes even your target audience is not going to be 100% happy with everything that happened. And that's the way it is, right? It is not a popularity or satisfaction is a very complicated term, and it doesn't mean satisfaction with every small choice that has been made, right? It's more satisfaction for me with the story as a whole, how likely would be to recommend it to a friend, how much enjoyment did you derive with this? But if the only comment is I really didn't like that bit, and, you know, it's not 90% of people commenting, then maybe we don't need to worry about that. And even when it's 90% of people, like, I get a lot of people complaining about pronoun choices, because Vietnamese has a weird pronoun system that is kinship based, right? So I would call somebody younger than me younger sister. And in a relationship between a man and a woman, the man is older brother and the woman is younger sister. And it's considered a fairly intimate way. And everybody's like, incest, how dare you? I try very hard not to point out to the existence of the English endearment term baby, but it's very hard. But you know, sometimes I'm just like, okay, yes, I admit it's weird for a lot of you, and I will stand by that because I think it's more important. So I guess it depends, really.
Well, there you go, Tim. That's some different answers and some advice for you. I hope that helps. You know, I'm thinking while you're all answering about this, and so I'm going to ask, so is there something that you particularly struggle with in world building? Is there an area where you feel you have a little bit of a disadvantage or a weakness? And how do you go about, what do you do to overcome that? Or how do you do to make that area work for you? Does anyone want to jump in and share something?
Oh, I am so bad at keeping records. I am so bad. I put things in randomly because I build as I go. And then I'm like, what was the name of that country again? Where was this? I'm really bad at keeping track of How do I overcome it? I wish I had a better method for overcoming it than just
you just search through piles of things until you find.
Yeah, I have to do a good like yeah. Oh, I'm bad at that.
Taryn, do you have any areas that are places where you struggle a little bit, and how do you deal with it? Or
well, I did once give a character three different ages, Marina, in three different novels that I wrote under a different name. So the copy editor caught me and I was like, oops. So keeping track of things is also a bit of a problem for me. But for me, the biggest thing is because I connect to my world building, I'm really focused on my characters. Sometimes I'll go until a much later draft than I should before I realize there's a logistical issue with my world building. But that can be fun too, because then like working out how to make the logics of that gap work will sometimes create an interesting subplot or like a new obstacle that arises very naturally from the story that I now have to overcome. So it does sometimes lead to some great things, but other times I'm like, oh crap, that doesn't make any sense. How did they get there?
Hugh, do you have any problems along the way and how do you deal with them?
Often it's setting up my the grand mystery of whatever the thing is. Like, yes, here's the thing. Like, okay, what is it then? I'm like, I've spent ages giving you loads of clues, but what is it? That's a very good question. Getting like that concluding bit to kind of like tie it all together at the end, and then having to go back and make sure it all makes sense along the way. I guess that's more in the fantasy stuff I've been doing, but. That's very much like, we have this ancient mystery. Like, yes, good. You've been talking about three books. I'm really excited to find out what it is. I'm like, yeah, me too. I'm looking forward to that.
Christopher, what about you?
My big world building difficulty is anything involving numbers. Just like logistics, moving people from place to place over time. You know, I have a faster than light travel method in the universe, but it's still so slow that it takes years and decades to get places. And sometimes, trying to maintain any sense of dramatic suspense under those conditions is very hard. You know, if it's going to take, you know, 30 years for relief to come to a siege, how do we actually have how do we have this battle work even, right? Or just getting timelines and logistics to line up. There was a scene midway through the series where I wanted characters to come back to a planet and for a character that left there to still be alive. And I looked at the timeline and realize, oh, not even if they were as genetically augmented as humanly possible would they still be alive. They are dead, unfortunately. I'm gonna have to figure out how to change things. So I had to re-outline that whole section and instead had that character leave a family and a legacy, and they had to meet, I think, like the fourth time great-granddaughter instead. And like, oh, I actually left a message for you. And so sometimes these challenges let you texture the story in you know, new and interesting ways. And so I often find like the limitations of the world building you've set up for yourself can make things give you opportunities for more creativity than you would have had just sort of in a vacuum. Man, am I bad at math. So.
Me too. You're talking about FTL. I struggled once to write a race between a hot air balloon and a boat because I wasn't sure how fast they were going, let alone faster than light. God.
Yeah.
And was that in the moon, in the moon's lack of atmosphere?
No, this was on a there was some water. It got very confusing. But yeah. speed is hard, especially if you're not like I'm not a boat person. I have no idea how fast things go. It was, yeah. Especially when I guess the advantage of sci-fi is you can make it up a little bit more sometimes and make it work. It depends how hard you want to go, I suppose.
Yeah.
If you've got it as mapped out as you are, Christopher, then maybe not. You've got hard rules.
Yeah, you can hide some things in the joints, right? But carpenters call that coping, so.
That's a very good word for it, I think.
Alia, did you have anything you wanted to add there? Is there any place that you struggle and how?
I'm usually terrible, like, it's a small thing, but it's like caused me trouble a couple of times, which is that when I need a random name for a character in the narration, I tend to fall back on the same names. So when I was writing a series, my copy editor at book two was like, hey, this guy, wasn't he working for the other faction? Isn't it great that he found a new job? And I was like,
oh, no.
I think we need a new name for the guy, right? So what I've started doing is I've started having a list, thinking through beforehand of a list of names I could give them, And then I sort of reach down the list and then cross them off as I take them, right? And then occasionally I will replenish the list and go like, okay, we need one more name, we need one more name, we need one more name. Because generally what happens is, you know, I'll be writing a scene and they'll be like, spare carrier number two enters and like is flying this spaceship and so on and so forth. And I'm like, what are they called? What is this, their spaceship? Oh my God. And that's usually where I go, I have a file for that. Their spaceship could be called the Moon and Teacups, and they could be, let's see.
Your own Mad Libs.
Yeah. I used to get names when I was still at like university postgrad stuff. I would just take names from whatever the pile of books I was doing an essay on at the time. I would just grab random first and terms, like, yeah, that's your name now. Sure, that'll do. It's a weakness of no longer being in academia. I have fewer random books on my desk at a time to draw from.
I had to get all my names checked. It was bad. Like some of them, like I made the decision of having them have a style name and an intimate name. So that plus grabbing them at random was a sort of like, okay, we're going to compile everything into a file and then we're going to take a good long look at them and go make sure that nobody's called the same thing as another person and that the naming conventions are being followed and that whatever name I reached for was the right social class for this character. And I don't know why I bother, actually. Nobody's ever going to notice that, but I guess I will, right? So it has to be done.
So I'm watching the time, and we still have some time left, but I do want to ask a question to all of you about power and about how you build power structures and how you immerse characters into settings that have power dynamics in your world building. And I wanted to leave it open to all of you to answer however you'd like, but I did want to kind of point a little bit in a direction or two with one or two of you. So Taryn, I wanted to point it, if you're okay with it, a little bit around language and the role of language and power in world building in your work, if you wouldn't mind. Could you talk about that?
I love languages. A lot of the book is about, the main character is a linguist. But he comes from a group of people who speak the language that is not the language of the land, basically the common language. And so for him, when he uses his own language, which he doesn't get to use very often because there's not many of his countrymen left alive, it carries a whole different emotional weight for him. And so there are people who in the book who have power over him. And if they can use his language, it carries a whole different relationship between him and them. Because there's always someone who has power. There's always someone who wants power. And in the case of main character in my book, there's someone who doesn't want power, doesn't want anything to do with it. And so to me, language can be really fun for defining social groups, obviously. And then what I like about language is the way it can define relationships. Like, I'm really very sad that English doesn't have the tofu distinction. Like, you can't switch between informal. Yeah, that's something I love about other languages. In Immortality Thief, there's a language that has degrees of intimacy, sort of like the way Japanese and Korean do, which then adds an extra context to his relationship with those characters. Just like when you share a language, that creates connection. When you choose not to use the shared language, that creates a strong rejection. Just the interpersonal ways that language can convey connections between people is very fascinating to me. I think you can display off really just relationships between characters, particularly power relationships.
Yeah, that's great. Marina, what about you? And I was going to maybe just point a little bit towards, does science and biology and things, you know, along those lines in the Numenum series play a role with power? Or what kinds of ways do you build power into the science fiction work you create?
Not to the science fiction work specifically. Because different people and different systems are held at higher regard in different points in time. You can always use somebody's situation to somebody else to show them basically whose narrative is going to be taken as the primary narrative. So if you have a person who's struggling and somebody else says, no, you're fine, do X, Y, and Z, and that's the point of view that is being upheld, you can show the power differential just by two different people looking at a situation and having a different interpretation of it. In Numenon, eventually you're going to have a lot of biological engineering happening for humans, and then you end up with a few humans who are not engineered. And then I get to discuss how the power play works there when you have people who are basically designed for jobs being upheld over people who are not designed for a job. And how do you still, does society still respect that person? Do they have any power? Do they have less power? You could even create a, you know, universe, obviously, that's inversed, where the person who's, you know, born the way they are versus the person who's engineered has the power. And it all kind of depends on what kind of narrative you're trying to tell, depending on who has the uplifted narrative.
And Christopher, you know, you're a good one to follow, I think, on that with, you know, you have some class distinctions that also have built into them different forms of power around the body and engineering. And you've got also some things like the Chantry and other things that are these regulatory oversight groups. Could you talk a little bit about how you play with that and power?
I just wanted to set up a sort of very, I guess, medieval or even a classical sort of society and to draw some pretty rigid distinctions, just because I think narratively that's interesting, and it's different than the world we live in certain ways, and maybe not in others. But I needed characters that were going to live a very long time, because of the sort of scale of the story that I wanted to tell. So I knew I wanted, this all really comes down to the space travel problem, really, which is that I think a lot of space opera tends to make space travel too easy and too quick, and as a consequence, make space less of a character. And so I wanted to do that differently. And if I was going to do that differently, I needed to do people differently. And so I sort of the class system arose out of a need to address the timescale issue, at least for the main cast, right? But there are like lots of different ways of getting to live longer in the Sun Eater universe. You can do things with cybernetics, which are deeply frowned upon by at least the imperial culture. You can do things genetically, which is more permissible, but you can do too many things genetically, and there's a line that you can cross, and sort of figuring out where those lines are helps to texture the universe in an interesting way, and the relationship between these groups of people too helps to texture the universe. And then with regard to things like the Chantry, the thing about governments and you know, power structures, bureaucratic power structures, is often there's a lot of duplication of effort. You have a lot of different institutions that kind of do the same thing, and they get in each other's way because they have their own individual missions. They're interested in aggrandizing themselves, even at the expense of their nominal fellow organs of the same institution, right? So, the military has its intelligence apparatus in the books, but the emperor has his own separate to that, and they get in each other's way, and they're both fighting against the clergy to certain extents. And so, people have a tendency, I think, to think of, when you think of, like, say, the United States government, you think of the United States government. But, you know, there are lots of organs within that general apparatus that don't always actually play for the same team, because there are factions and things like that. And that's a place for me that's been very fun to sort of generate conflict in, because it's I'm not saying that I'm the only person who does this, but it is something that one sees less in the Star Warses, let's say, of science fiction. And so that's been sort of a separate but related issue to the whole class thing.
Interesting. And Aliette, did you want to follow on that? I mean, you also do a lot with social rank and standing and privilege,
yeah,
right, in
the universe. Yeah. I think it's quite an interesting, like, for instance, in the Fireborn of Exile, which is the latest Suya universe, it's set within a power transition where the military used to have the power in the series of asteroids where the series is set, and it's transitioning out of military rule and into scholar rule, which is the more classical way of doing things in the Empire. So you obviously get, I mean, Chris was talking about those bureaucracies. Yeah, they very much get in each other's way and they're very much competing with each other. And also, you know, there's the added bonus of like one of them definitely feels like they're losing that particular battle. But I think some of the things that I find really interesting are the liminal spaces and the way in which the markers of higher social rank get co-opted by people on the lower social ranks. So you get people who are trying to pretend that they have the kind of like high quality virtual clothes that are the province of the high class people because it makes their lives easier. And then obviously, you know, the high class people are very judgy about that in return, and you get all sorts of interesting stratifications. And that's just, you know, people who are actually from the same sort of ethnic origin. There's also a whole series of separate prejudices of like the people from the shipyards, and the people from the shipyards have a different accent and they're kind of like one step removed from the barbarians who are on the outside of the Empire. So you get also this very nasty dynamics of like they are not like us, which are sadly fairly commonplace, and a lot of that remains in the background or it's very small details. Like somebody will take a look at somebody else's clothes and go like, yeah, I know where they're coming from. And it's only specific characters, right? Some characters will just go like, sorry, what? I just see like pretty peaches and stuff, right? And some characters who are more used to having to navigate that world will go like, okay, this social class, this person probably doing that, or sort of like, you know, Sherlock Holmes, except the stakes are like rather higher than whether you are going to solve the problem. It could literally mean life and death if you cross the wrong person. And I find those are very interesting to play with. They add a lot of texture and detail. I try not to let them overwhelm. So I have a tendency to just, you know, under-explain that and just leave it as a sort of like, okay, some characters notice a lot. And then some others just go through life completely oblivious. Weirdly enough, those characters tend to have the most problems afterwards.
Okay, and Hugh, what about you? Maybe in Ad Luna specifically, like how did you craft power between the different factions and groups and species, et cetera?
I guess it started out as almost like I didn't consciously get into it so much within the factions, because it's very Greco-Roman. It's very like there's a king and there's some other people as well. And then it ended up being quite a military hierarchy because it was the Space Elf army, as it were, which made life fairly simple. There were ranks, you're done. But then there's a whole section where they're in the court of the King of the Sun trying to explain, like trying to negotiate and do all sorts of things. And that's very much some little guys versus absolute power. And it is absolute power because it's the King of the Sun and they're sitting in a box inside the sun. So they are very much at their mercy there. It's not subtle in the way that you could construct it. It's very much there is someone in power and there are people who are not in power at all, and finding a little way to just get the underdog stuff in there. I've not really done like complex political power structure stuff yet, I suppose. You never know. I tend to end up being little guys versus something big and slightly more oppressive in some way.
Well, that's a great segue to my final question, which is a fun one, to wrap things up. And this one is there a world you want to write but haven't? Either one of your own invention or an existing fictional world created by others. We're going with IP be damned on this one. So, you know, it's an open field. But, you know, is there a world that you have in mind in your own work that you'd like to write that you haven't yet? Or is there a world you'd like to drop into and write something in? Christopher, I'm going to start with you on that.
There is a planet in my own setting that I haven't gotten to do a lot with, and that's Jed. Jed is in the most recent book for like 5 chapters, and I would like to go back. It's very sort of Indo-Persian, and this is a period of history and a pair of cultures that I've been very interested in for the last few years. So I've been doing a lot of reading, a lot of research, and trying to science fictionalize that and to sort of play with those pieces would be very fun, and to do the historical reference credit and respect and all of that as well, of course, but because it is well outside my experience. But I like learning things, right? And you know, talking about research early on too, I never really stop. I just, you know, whatever I'm sort of interested in at the moment tends to find its way into my work. And so to be able to put some of that, you know, hobby research to practice would be nice.
That's great. Elliot, what about you?
Well, I mean, I'd love to write something for Star Wars, but I think also the sheer weight of like all the world, the existing world building for Star Wars would just break my mind. So I'm of two minds about this. And in my own universe, I want to write more stories which are set in the aforementioned shipyards. And the reason I haven't yet is because it's going to echo a lot of, because of the historical parallels, it's going to echo a lot of issues and questions about ethnic minorities within Vietnam, and I don't know if I'm ever going to do that because that's a fraught question and I don't feel really qualified for that. So let's see where I feel. Great. How I feel in a couple of years about that.
Great. Taryn, what about you?
There is a solution to Einstein's general relativistic equations that is, I forget the name of it, but it's a rotating universe. And because the universe is rotating, moving through the universe creates time travel. Like you travel in time as you travel in space because the universe is rotating. And I have always thought that would be an incredibly cool setting, but it's causality wise, extremely difficult to figure out how that works, but it's very cool. There's simulations on, you know, available on like YouTube of what it would look like if you like tossed a ball in one direction and it bounced back as you would see it coming as you saw it going. So it's a little esoteric.
Wow, that's super cool.
That's cool. Do it.
Yeah, do it.
Let's try. Read that. Let's go.
Do it because it's already done, right? You already did it.
Yeah, there we go. I'm done now.
Okay, Hugh, what about you?
In a less sort of highbrow, I want to blow more stuff up in space. I've got bits and pieces of like sort of space submarine warfare and things like that. I'd like to kind of I might tie it all together someday. I'm not quite sure how, but it's in that sort of slightly Warhammer 40k-esque vibe of like, yeah, space is big and full of horrible aliens who want to eat us all. And it's not exactly complex, but it is fun to write, and I want to do some more of that.
That sounds great. And Marina, what about you?
Oh man, there's so many things. If I got to write in an IP, probably Supernatural, what feels like out of left field, but I've like had an outline for a Supernatural tie-in novel for like years now. Anyway, but my own stuff, there is this like alternate history from World War II onward diesel punk with kaiju thing that's also been playing in my head forever that I just would love to eventually actually dive into and get to do. So.
Wow, that sounds awesome. Well, thank you all so much. This has been really such an interesting and insightful and also fun conversation, and it's really been illuminating. And so I want to thank you all for taking the time to come today and share your thoughts on building believable sci-fi worlds. In the time we have left, I would like to have you all go around and let people know where they can find you on social media, what you've got coming, what's just come out, what you're working on, anything sort of news related. And I'm just going to maybe go back probably in somewhat of a reverse order as best I can remember. So Marina, we're going to start with you.
All right. Well, you can find me at loftsetter.com and at Marina Loftsetter on Blue Sky, I think. And the third book in the Helm of Midnight series, which is a fantasy series, should be coming soon-ish. I don't think we've even released the title of it yet. But this one is my serial killer epic fantasy series, which also has a lot of like hidden history and layers of world building to it. I world built like three different times in order to do the layers in that one. So it's fun. So anyway, that's my series I'm going to pitch there. So.
That sounds awesome. Hugh, how about you?
If you search my name, I am blessed with a slightly unusual name combination. No one else has ever existed in the world with my name, which is really handy for SEO, I'm not going to lie. But I'm at Hewage on like everything on Blue Sky and Twitter and whatever you can find me on, basically. It's a good username. In terms of upcoming stuff, I am trying to finish off Boiling Seas Fantasy Trilogy this year, hopefully. And all being well, I don't actually know when, but hopefully there should be another one of these coming soon with meat in it, which is nice. But we'll see how that goes. Should be.
And didn't you just have one come out as well recently?
Yes, that's this one.
Okay.
But hopefully there's another one soon.
Great.
Maybe. I don't know when, but yeah.
Taryn, how about you?
I'm working on the sequel to The Immortality Thief, which is called The Unkillable Princess. And you can find me at TarynHunt.com and on Facebook, Instagram, Blue Sky, Tumblr, and also Twitter, although it's Twitter.
Look at you. Wow. Social media. It's great. Aliette, how about you?
I have a website and a newsletter at aliettipodar.com and a Patreon that's linked from there. I'm Aliette DB, so my first name and my initials on Instagram and Blue Sky mainly, and a bit of Mastodon those days, and not very much on Twitter anymore because Twitter. My most recent book is A Fireborn of Exile, which is a sapphic Count of Monte Cristo in space with disaster lesbians. That always helps. And I have Navigational Entanglement coming from Tor.com in sometime in the summer. I'm afraid I've forgotten the release date because it's moved around a couple of times, and which is basically sort of Wuxia-inspired space opera, so with fighting clans and juniors on a mission that may or may not have been set up to kill them all.
So I'm reading one.
Yeah, that sounds amazing. And Christopher, how about you?
Yeah, so I have a website that's solanempire.com, solanempire.com. But I'm also here on YouTube at Sun Eater Books. I'll probably be live streaming tonight, actually. Do that once a month. My next book, Disquiet Gods, is out on April 2nd. You can pre-order that wherever books are sold. That's the sixth Sun Eater book. So that is that's the next thing. It is actually available for sort of early access from Bane.com. They sell their advanced reading copies. So if you want to read that early, if anyone watching is caught up on the series and would like to, you can read it today. Thank you.
Great. Well, once again, thank you all for coming and spending your time sharing your insights with us. I really appreciate it. And I know that everyone watching does as well. So that's it. We're wrapped up. So this is TBRCon 2024, Building Believable Sci-Fi Worlds, signing off. Thanks, everyone, for coming. I hope you enjoyed it.